You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
It's a very personal film, and you're making it for very personal reasons, obviously, for your baby girl. So I guess, is she why you made this film, or are there bigger reasons?
Yeah, I mean, it was probably when I started it, she was only two, and I was just quite overwhelmed by what lay ahead for her future and the constant narrative that was emerging around the future, which is pretty dystopian, whether it was news reports or social media, but even films. You know, any Hollywood film you watch is invariably a world with no nature. Robots are chasing humans in slums. Like, it's not portrayed as a very optimistic future. So I was struggling of how to have that conversation, I guess, with my daughter. And then I just started doing some research and to see if there were things we could do. What were the solutions that were out there to some of these problems? And I was pretty gobsmacked to learn how much was going on and how little we were hearing about it. And then I spoke to this amazing woman called Renee Lertzman in the US, who's an environmental psychologist. And she told me that when we do receive information that comes with this fear or dread or overwhelm, that it activates a part of our brain called the limbic system. And when that's activated, it shuts down the prefrontal cortex, which is where we problem solve and we think creatively. So I just felt like there was room to bring in a new narrative, which is, you know, not to make it all Pollyanna and say we're going to be fine, but just to say, you know what? There are people doing great things. There are solutions that exist. How about we give them a little bit of focus?
That's really interesting about the actual, the physical reaction, I suppose, to that sort of information. Because I suppose, one of the things, I mean, the film, I'm going to come back to the research because I'm interested in that. But the film is immediately hopeful. It's such a light, soft tone. It's very not Pollyanna, but it's not really even happy clappy. It's just it's soft, it's gentle, and it's not doom and gloom. You literally say fact-based dreaming. So I mean, that probably goes back to the research, this is a purposeful decision, I guess. What I'm trying to ask is, doesn't the doom and gloom has a place, though, right? It's really important.
Absolutely. And I think it's important. Not enough of our leaders around the world acknowledge how bad things are and let themselves feel the depth of what that means. And certainly our children are doing that. I've had friends ring me up, you know, when the UN released their report about the million species extinction. You know, the 13-year-old was in tears at the kitchen table. Now, imagine our leaders were doing that and actually being honest with how they feel about this. So absolutely, it's not to say that we need to run away from that. And I think people that see the film, like, I couldn't shirk from the realities of what is happening. So I had to show that and also say that, you know, things are going to be bad in 20 years. There are going to be things that we've already set in motion that we can't change. But how we deal with those things is a decision we get to make right now, rather than arriving at that place in 20 years and going, oh no, shit, what do we do now? I just want to plant the seeds of some of the solutions that we can act upon. So, yeah, that was a constant discussion I had, is how do we not make this feel utopian? And I wouldn't want to do that to my daughter and say, everything's going to be fine, honey. That's why this fact-based dreaming was really important. Everything I show her in the film has to exist now. I can't make it up. It's just an extrapolation of what already exists.
But you actually have young kids in there, right? There's like there's these beautiful moments with young children who are dreaming, not confined by facts, I suppose you could say. And why did you include those?
I think the worst thing I could have done is make a vision of the future based on a kind of privileged white guy and his, I mean, that's just not the world we're in right now. So I can't avoid that I was born that way. There's elements to that, but I think there's a responsibility that I had the opportunity to then go and consult people and find out what they wanted to see in 2040, and the kids especially. They're the ones that are going to be in their peak at that era. So we went to Tanzania, Bangladesh, Brooklyn, Europe, 110 kids from around the world. And I just said, you know, what do you want the world to be like in 2040? And I think what's beautiful about kids is that they're dreamers and they are visionaries. And we suppress that part of ourselves as we get older. We're told, oh, get in the real world. That's fantasy. But it's actually a crucial part of who we are. We need to imagine and dream, and we just don't do it as much anymore, especially with the bombardment of content we have now. We're on our phones all the time. We're not sort of sitting back and reflecting or dreaming. Like even the great artists through history did, Van Gogh, you know, with the sunflowers, he didn't come home and just check his Instagram feed. He just stared at the photo or the flowers for 2 hours and then drew them. But we don't let ourselves do that as much anymore. So the kids still have that quality, and I thought it was really important to put them in there because they're talking about intrinsic values that we all connect with. You know, if you ask most adults, they'd say similar things to what those kids would want. So I reckon they're just they're an absolutely pivotal part of the film.
There's animation and these kind of surreal moments when you're sitting on top of a windbine, are they called? A
wind turbine.
Yep, that one.
It should be shortened to windbine. I think that's much better.
So there's these kind of surreal moments, and there's also this use of these kind of cardboard cutouts. Now, I'm wondering if this is like a throwback to your short film with your wife.
Yeah, it's just about, I think, that sometimes documentaries can be pretty dry and reverent and earnest, and you know, this topic in particular, how do we engage the public? How do we make it really accessible? And I wanted families to come along. That's what worked with Sugar. And it's the same now. I mean, the film's been out for 9 weeks in Australia. It's still going in the cinemas. And it's just, you know, in the top five Aussie docos of all time now because people are bringing their kids and then they're driving home and having a conversation about the film. And I don't think that can be said a lot with climate films. I think that the way we've told the story, and rightly so to a degree, is look how shit our planet is. Look how the reefs are dying. Look how what we're doing. It's such a bombardment that it's really hard, not only for kids to experience that, but also for people that have had a big day at work. The last thing you want to do is go and watch a film about how bad the reefs are. We do care, but it's very hard to connect. So I guess I just wanted to play with that form a little bit and try and be more inviting and welcoming and use hope as a real motivator, which, you know, any work of psychology, the work of Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, all talks about how important hope is to us as humans as a way to move forward. The idea or possibility of a better future is an enormous motivator to humans, and we're just not getting enough of that with the climate issue.
With, I guess, and Jai, on the generational point too, I suppose that sort of engagement or kind of playful things that you include, that means that younger people can connect to it, and then adults are obviously hearing the information.
Absolutely. And I think there's, you know, and I know this myself, but we're far more instead of just seeing a person talking in front of a bookcase, we're used to that in documentaries. You sort of switch off and go, okay. But if suddenly there's something new and that speaker's in a different position, they're all sitting on a wind turbine, they're shrunk on a Monopoly board, there's a level of engagement in the brain that kicks in that's different. And it's saying, hang on, what's this about? And so you've got your ability to absorb the information is fundamentally higher.
Wow.
Hmm.
Did you research that?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
That actually makes sense. So you're actually forcing your audience to make – you're making them listen to
There's
you.
There's a little bit of that.
Wow.
But also it's a fine line because if you go too far and it becomes a bit trite and silly and, you know, then you lose them that way as well. So it's a constant dance between what is enough and what's right. And I probably think a couple of times I probably could have pulled back a little bit more even though the kids love those bits. You know, I was really aware of this playing to sort of 8 and above. So if I'd known it was an older audience, I would have changed it. But – you know, parents are still loving the film, but I love that kids are also understanding it and finding it exciting and because of those effects.
The film itself, it does require people to have that conversation afterward, right? It's not a end, it doesn't end here, right? You've literally, like, you've made this incredible film. Mm-hmm. People that watch it are going to be like, fuck, this is awesome. I didn't know these things existed. Then what, though? Mm-hmm. Because yes, they exist. What is the person supposed to do with that information?
So that's probably the most exciting thing about this project is that the film is a tiny piece of a much larger ecosystem we've already built. So we were part of an organisation in Australia called Good Pitch, and basically I had to pitch the idea of the film to a room of 400 philanthropists. And they gave us a huge amount of money, not for the film, but to develop materials off the back of the film to engage people and so they could take action. So if you go to our website, whatsyour2040.com, there is, we've teamed up with 50 different organizations around the world. There's a button that says activate your plan. And when you hit that button, we ask you what you resonated with in the film, what kind of person you are, how much time you have available. And we'll give you 6 or 7 things that you can do on your own, with your community, with your family and your school. And we've just had an extraordinary response to that. So there's a microgrid technology in the film that's in Bangladesh. We teamed up with an Aussie company to do an equity crowdfund to bring it to Australia. They raised $3.5 million in 2 weeks. There's a project that pays farmers to put carbon back in the soil. They've had 100 farmers sign up. We've got 9,000 a month pledged already. The seaweed platform that you saw, we're launching the first one in Australia off Bruny Island, Tasmania. Crowdfunded that for $350,000. We're 40 grand short. So all these points, there's 50 different things that you can do to say, yes, if you cared, yes, if your heart's open right now and you really give a shit about your kid's future, come this way. join us, because look at all these legends that are trying to get on with and solve this, and you can be part of that movement, which we're calling the regeneration. There's a really simple thing that people can do, which is that you might have seen it in the film. There's a search engine called Ecosia, and instead of Google, they just use the ad money to plant trees around the world. So they've doubled their users in Australia since the film's come out. They've had 175,000 searches in Australia, so we've planted nearly 6,000 trees. Just from people who watch the film searching. Like, it's that simple.
That's so cool.
But you think about even the carbon that that's sequestering. So this is the power of storytelling. You know, yeah. This is what it can do. And that's why I think the lesson I've learned through this whole process is that we are in a battle of stories right now, and especially in our country, which is really, you know, our governments are climate deniers pretty much, and they're not doing anything, and our emissions keep going up and up. But if you look who controls our media and our landscape, it's a particular person, and they're telling a narrative that coal's still important, and people aren't hearing about these solutions. They aren't hearing about these other great things that are going on. So I think it's really important for filmmakers or songwriters or poets or artists or whatever to actually start getting this stuff out there.
I'm going to go into the difficult stuff now.
Great.
So the experts, basically, that you found, how did you find them? How did you find all these brilliant ideas?
So, yeah, that was 8 months. So I was with a researcher who worked for the ABC for a science show in Australia, and we spent 8 months just looking, writing lists and lists of solutions, who to talk to. I reckon I spoke to 70 or 80 different academics, scientists, economists, just to get a sense of what was true, what were viable solutions, what were the ones that were fanciful, like, as I really wanted to make sure we didn't sensationalize this, because I think you're going to lose so many people if you get it wrong. It really had to be this fact-based dreaming and grounded in truth. So that took a long time to get right. But again, once we started to distill the solutions by saying all these solutions had to have cascading benefits. So it wasn't enough just to pull carbon out of the atmosphere. You know, with the soil one, it helps the quality of our food. It strengthens rural communities. It retains water, which is desperately needed. The seaweed regenerates oceans and increases fish populations. You can use the seaweed for all these materials, but it also happens to be sequestering carbon at a turbocharged rate. So we really just found these key pillars and had to make sure that these solutions, even if climate change wasn't happening, we'd want to do them anyway. Like, empower girls and women. Great, let's do that regardless. Yeah. But the beautiful bonus is that you potentially avoid a billion people on the planet by getting that right. So it's a lovely sort of cascading benefit to something we should already do.
Finding the people and doing the research, what was your level of understanding of sort of climate, even terminology? Like, what level did you, how long did you spend learning this stuff to ask the right questions?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I'd spent the last 4 years so immersed in nutrition and sugar in that space that I really had to do a crash course in that 8 months. And that was why it was so important, just to get up to speed on. And again, I could relate to why people aren't connecting with this issue, because if you think about it, quite often we've left it to the scientists to do the communicating, and they use words like anthropogenic, negative emissions, 2 degrees warming. Like, they're such amorphous terms. We actually don't really know what they mean. So I had to, again, reacquaint myself with what it actually meant, and then find ways or analogies to use to really simplify it so that I could understand it and then communicate it in the film and through the right effects, or to make it really simple and digestible. So that was a huge process. And I probably read almost 30 books, I reckon, in that year, of just trying to get up to speed, see what was out there. And then I'd get recommended and someone say, oh, you've got to speak to this professor and speak to this doctor. So before we did any filming, I really had a clear sense of what was going on, and then could start to discern what was going to be the best filmically. You know, for example, one of the number one solutions to reversing climate change is actually refrigeration management. So changing the gases in our air conditioners and our fridges. But it's the most unsexy thing to film in the world, like okay. The fridge film. Yeah. So again, even though that was really good information, it was like, oh, that's not going to cut in a film.
Right. Yeah.
So it was just trying to find, you know, ways that people were going to relate to.
You still had to be a film seller in a way.
Totally.
I kind of using that, you know, it almost sounds like it kind of happened organically. You start to look, and then it comes, right? It's
exactly,
there.
Exactly.
And that's what you're trying to say. I thought that, I mean, throughout the film, and you probably, like, this was the avoiding the doom and gloom thing, but there was not a lot of, I guess, discussion around why. I mean, there's very deliberate reasons that we don't know the stuff. Mm-hmm. There's very deliberate reasons we're not educated on these words even. Yep. There's deliberate reasons that that the electric grid is illegal, yeah, or, you know, like, right, to do that. So there's, is it about political will? Is it because we don't have the education? Is it because we there's vested financial interests in the fossil fuel industry? You know, yeah, like, there's all of these things. That's why, right, was it that you sort of didn't go into detail about that?
Well, in one of the first cuts of the film we did, it was 3 hours and 20 minutes, the film, and I had almost 45 minutes on the economy and the rules of the game and the trade treaties and all the blocks to progress and what's stopping us there. The section that we left in there about Exxon and the Koch brothers and that tactic, that was probably another 10 minutes longer. But unfortunately, it felt like a different film. It actually felt like a film all on its own. And that was the toughest part of this film, was taking the majority of that out, because I felt it means a lot to me and I want people to know it. But it suddenly just took it out of an aspirational, dreaming film. And I sort of thought, you know what we need right now is something that people can fight for and not fight against. We kind of all know that the system's broken. We know capitalism is in a really dire state. We know we're being manipulated by corporations. Governments are failing. No one's got trust in these institutions. We kind of get that. So I just wanted to make an antidote to that a little bit and give people this sort of hour and a half in the cinema of going, oh, right, there are things we can do. Because I think a lot of people don't even realise that. There's a nihilistic narrative that's emerged that says, you know what, I think we're fucked. Like, and a lot of people do think that. And I think it's really important we don't let that take hold, because that's when people get paralysed and they shut down and go, what's the point anyway? I'm just going to keep partying and trash the planet. Who cares? So it was really important to counter that narrative. And again, because we've got this platform that's been funded, we've already released those clips that I had to cut out. So, and they're getting enormous traction just on our social media, on YouTube, because people are seeing that there's more to this. Again, this was just the entry point to bring in an audience. Then you start introducing them to these concepts. Whereas, right, I think if it had been that from the get-go, it wouldn't be a top five Australian documentary of all time. It would be probably released on the internet and seen as a bit of an alternative, whereas I think there's a Trojan horse element to this a little bit.
Yeah, okay.
And we did the same with Sugar. It was like, just let Sugar's the really simple entry point to actually learning more about nutrition and who you are. If you try and do it all, and again, how do you describe our entire system in a feature film? Like, it's just impossible. So there were really tough choices to be made there. And you know, I still have moments where it would have been nice to have that in, but invariably it comes up at Q&As and we have great conversations about it. And it's still kick-starting that chat anyway.
Yeah, I guess I do want to have the conversation.
Yeah.
And it's not to say, I'm not expecting you to have the answer, but I guess it's also that, you know, if we do know that the system is broken, but nothing's changed, why? Like, what, you know, if we're already paralyzed, I guess, and yes, this is a way out of that, but there are so many other things at play.
But I wrote a book off the back of this as well, and that's, again, a lot of this stuff is in there to explain, because really there isn't one thing, and that's why this is so tricky to condense in a film format. Because even the economy section, we look at our sort of addiction to growth on a planet that is fast running out of resources. We can't replenish the resources we're using each year. So that's a conversation that no one's having. That's probably the most important conversation. Then you look at the amount of how we've switched all of our power from a centralized government structure to corporations, and the rules they get away with at a high level behind closed doors in the WTO, the trade treaties, things that people have no idea about that affect the flow of resources right around the world. We have to unlock some of those and make them more democratic, because at the moment it's just a trade minister or a finance minister that's attending those meetings, yet they're affecting the social fabric of who we are, the environment. We should have representatives at the table having that discussion as well. And then you look at the simple thing, and what your country's doing so well is, how can we just measure our progress on GDP and income when who we are is fundamentally more complex and interesting than that? And we value all sorts of things, from community to psychological well-being to gender, all these other things that we just don't measure in society. We put it all down to finance. So until we can undo that, we're just going to keep trashing the things we love, because we're not giving them any meaning. We're not bringing them and making them visible in our public space. So just those three things alone are a huge thing we have to deal with. The constant debt that's in society right now, where such debt, you know, 95% or 90% of the money is debt, which promotes this constant growth. So we're trapped in this circle. But again, trying to fit all that into a film, it suddenly becomes a very negative, heavy film. And I just really wanted this to be something different. And I, you know, it's interesting. I've already been asked by a couple of people to make that other film. So I'm you know, pretty sure at this stage I'm going to tell that story in some capacity, or there's some another TV show has come up to, can you do an hour just on the economy? So I do want to get that out. I think it's important. But like I said, this was just the... This was the opening. This was the way in for people that just aren't connecting on this topic. And so I just thought that was an important decision to make.
It's also, I mean, it, yes, the economy, yes, capitalism, totally finance, all of these issues. But again, I often go back to the political will, because actually the power is, I mean, governments can do this. They can make changes. They can make decisions.
They can, but I think there's an illusion that our leaders... I mean, your leader is actually doing an extraordinary job, but most leaders around the world are beholden to that economic system that's already in place. So imagine any leader that proposed a degrowth model and said, we're actually going to go into a recession. They'd be booted out in a flash, whereas that's actually what we need to do. We need to find ways of slowing down this expansion, because, like I said, we're destroying the planet by how much we're consuming each year. So it's, in a sense, our political leaders are puppets to a much larger system that's a machine that's just rolling down the road. So I agree, we've got huge problems there, but I don't, I mean, yes, it's very important that we still acknowledge that system and know that our leaders can help us. But I think what we're starting to see is that it's not going to happen in most countries like mine or America at that top level. It's got to happen at a local level. It's got to happen from, as we're seeing in Australia now, there's the, I think the 30th Council just declared a climate emergency. Even though our federal government aren't going to go anywhere near it, it's happening by all these different councils. So people are getting involved and taking action. And that's what's happened throughout history. It's never from the top that these things have happened.
And so what you're hoping is actually people engaging with these sort of models that you propose, and then all of the other ones that you've kind of been exposed to.
Yeah, we've got to teach our leaders how to lead on this topic, because they actually have no clue. And they're not even looking at it, because it's such a threat to the current paradigm and the status quo, that they don't really want to know about this stuff yet. They're like the fossil fuel companies. They all know it's happening. The transition's coming. We've done screenings for them. We've met them. Some of them have even put a carbon tax on themselves, because they know the government's not doing it, because they know a transition's happening. So they're going to cling on and make as much money as from their assets as they can until they're dragged away kicking and screaming. So it's not going to come from them. It has to be us, like the suffragettes and the women marching in the streets, you know, and we're told to get off the streets. Men make this, they kept going. Like the interracial marriage in America that just started state by state and eventually it tipped. You know, like the abolitionists with slavery, it's exactly the same thing. They're all told that it was utopian to think the economy would survive without slaves. And 60 years later, bang, they had a revolution. I reckon we're in that right now. And we've got Greta Thunberg, we've got these kids right around the world that are marching, that we'll look back at them in 20 or 30 years. And this is a similar moment. This is a historic transition we're in right now. And it might get a bit ugly and it's going to get clunky. But from what I've seen in the last 3 years, and even since releasing the film, it's undeniable that it's going to happen. And especially from your generation and younger, that's where the hope is, because they're not going to stop. And they're so passionate about it. And they're saying, we want to treat this planet differently. And would you just bloody get out the way and let us do it? And there is going to be a moment where that happens, you know, and how much damage we've done to that point is the big discussion. Let's hope that we haven't done too much. But I get quite emotional when I see these kids marching and the passion they've got. And, you know, it's so inspiring. And I feel like my generation has to help. You know, we can't just leave it to them, but we've got to at least guide them through and say, yep, we're with you. Let's go.
It's a really good place to cut it and keep going. Because there's almost, and I agree, we've been, I mean, a part of the younger generation or older generation, I don't know. But there's, and you're right, we can't just leave them to it, but we've also left them it. We are leaving them this house which is full of smoke.
Yeah.
And it's almost, to some extent, I'm always like, you know, why we find children so hopeful because they dream and it's this incredible passion and all of these things. Why do we rely on that so much?
I know. Because part of it, I think, is because we become cynical because we were all that once and we had those dreams and then it got shut down by the society and the system. We're told not to be those people anymore. And what's really interesting in the screenings we've done so far, especially to energy companies and big corporations, you forget that there are human beings all working in those organizations who deeply care and often have kids and want to do something about it. They just don't know what to do. They're caught in a system. They're working at a job to provide, you know, security for their own families, but they know the job they're doing is destroying things. So there's this really interesting conflict going on at the moment where everyone's a hypocrite. No one can do the right thing. It's this really clunky transition phase. And I think people are turning to those kids because they're often voicing what they want to voice themselves, but they might be in a certain structure that they can't, you know, they can't yell that out at work, but somewhere they're admiring the kids and their enthusiasm and their unbridled passion, and the blinkers are off. They haven't been, they haven't built up stuff over the years that suppressed that. And I think a lot of people have that still in them, and they do dream of a greener future and less buddy traffic and quieter, like, community. We all want that deep down. It's kind of how we evolved as humans. So I think the kids remind us of that constantly and remind us of that inner child that we all still have.
Have you read Catherine Ingram's essay, Facing Extinction?
I haven't. I know Catherine Ingram's work, but I haven't read that essay. Okay. No.
It's a powerful read, but she actually encourages people not to have children as one of the many solutions.
Yes.
I struggle with this because I don't think it's anybody's right to tell somebody
what
to do or what not to do, you know, and especially, and as a woman, I'm like, don't fucking tell me what to do with my womb. For one, that's been done for a long time.
You've had enough of that.
No more of that.
Yeah.
But obviously this is a solution that is offered by a lot of people, and actually, it's racialized too, in a way, because there are certain countries which are often as to blame for overpopulation and that sort of thing. And yes, there's facts in that, and there's numbers and stats and all of these things. But we're talking about bringing kids into the world, and it's a natural thing that we've done. And now it's like this reality of actually, no, I'm making a deliberate decision not to bring a child because they're going to suffer, or because no more population. You know, I don't know. I'm just sort of, it's a thing that I always wonder about. I just wonder what you think.
Yeah, well, I think it's, what's interesting at the moment is that society's become a real moral point scoring stadium, and you see it right now. Everyone's trying to win points and do the right thing and be the best, and I'm the best human. And I don't think, that's not who we are. None of us are perfect. And I think the last thing we want to do right now is impose. It's like veganism too. I have full respect for vegans. If that's their choice, great. It's not my, you know, I don't particularly do that. I still have a little bit of meat. We make sure that it's regeneratively farmed. It's proper meat. But I would never begrudge someone for that choice. And I think if this person's got an opinion about that, fair enough. But each of us have to decide what we think is right for us. And having had a daughter myself, it's the most sensational and beautiful thing we can ever do. How I raise her and how we raise her and educate her is, I think, the really important thing for her to understand the importance of resources and not excess. That's the bigger problem. I think that we can get through this as humans living fundamentally different, whether it's a sharing economy, whether it's a circular economy. There are ways that we can use much less resources than we are right now, because let's face it, it's a completely extractive, wasteful, use, make, create, throwaway society, and that's not working for anyone. So I would kind of hope that if people are going to choose to have children, to understand that they're going to be brought in with a whole different set of cultural norms than we've had. And I've seen that interviewing kids around the world. I see that with my own daughter and her friends. We had to do something at Splendor in the Grass last week at the big festival in Australia. And her and her friends are walking around the festival picking up plastic bottles and going, Dad, we can't have this rubbish. And the teenagers are looking at them going, oh my God, there's this fleet of 6-year-olds just picking up rubbish. Because that's how their brains are thinking about respecting the planet and doing things differently. So I don't think it's ever as black and white, just like veganism. It's never black and white. There's so much nuance that we don't get on social media. I think the same. If someone chooses to not have a child, that's absolutely their choice. But there are ways to still have a child and do it in a different way. If you're going to do it the current way and have 5 televisions and fly every single... Yeah, of course, there's going to be problems. But I would hate to begrudge someone the absolute magic of having a child, because it's spectacular. But how you raise that child is your responsibility, and it's important to get up to speed with what's deleterious and what's regenerative in terms of how you treat the planet.
Is there anything else you want to add?
I guess it was, I'd probably say that, you know, what I've realized in the last 3 years is that climate change is actually an opportunity. What we're being presented is feedback to fundamentally do things different and interact with each other, the planet, soils, ocean, in a whole new way. It's a shifting paradigm. And it's like going to the doctor, and you go and he tells you or she tells you that you've got this certain illness. You've got a choice now. You can keep going, keep smoking, not exercising and eating shit food, and you're going to get sick and you might even die. But you can change your ways at this point, and actually create a much better, healthier life for you. And I feel like that's the feedback we're getting right now from the planet, and it's up to us to decide. So the more we can reframe this as an opportunity to fundamentally change and live a better life, connected to each other, communities, to the foods we eat, that's what's on offer. You know, so it's which way we go is now up to us. But I think if we're not careful, people are just going to lose hope and give up and think we can't do this. And I see that amongst even my friends. So I just think it's really important to get this alternate narrative out there.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.